This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 20th of August 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. It may be August in the Northern Hemisphere, but we have a particularly chilly lineup for you today, with reports on new architectural projects in both Scotland and the Antarctic. Coming up today, Monocle's very own Alexa Firminich heads to Edinburgh to meet with Japanese architectural master Kengo Kuma regarding his new commission in Dundee for the Victoria and Albert Museum.
As I want to create the conversation between nature and the city.
We're staying in Scotland, this time in Glasgow, where David Pleasant pays a visit to a new exhibition showcasing the most exciting research stations that have been built recently in Antarctica.
It is really the only one that's located on a moving, floating ice shelf. So actually it's not properly founded on the Antarctic continent, it's literally bobbing about on the ocean. And that brings with it some amazing challenges.
And we'll meet London Design Museum's director, Dejan Sujic, and discuss the impending relocation to Kensington.
The chance to actually bring it back to life, to give the museum 10,000 square metres in a place in which we think when we open in 2015 we'll be looking at something like 500,000 visitors a year, is a fantastic chance to do something special.
Plus, I chat with Monocle's fashion director, Takaharu Sato, upon his return from Copenhagen Fashion Week. And we take a tour of Asla & Chan Alte's studio over in Şişhane, Turkey. That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Welcome to the show with me, Tom Morris. This is the first of many hours we'll be spending together, hearing all about the most exciting new happenings in the world of design, architecture and fashion. First up, we're in Scotland. Monocle's David Pleasant went to the Lighthouse in Glasgow, where a new exhibition is investigating the recent proliferation of research stations around the South Pole. Science, technology, and above all design and beautiful architecture are revealed, showcasing some of the most exciting and adventurous structures being built down there by everyone from Korea to India. Here's David's report.
Today, I ventured north to Glasgow to see an exhibition that looks at architecture in the extreme south of the planet. On the South Pole, to be precise, New Architecture and Science in Antarctica is an international touring exhibition that showcases some of the extraordinary structures that are springing up on the world's most remote and inhospitable terrain. However, despite the harsh climate and high-tech functions of many of the stations, on first appearances, the exhibition shows how design and aesthetic considerations are being taken very seriously. I'm going to go in and meet some of the people behind the show.
My name is Hugh Broughton. I'm an architect and I design research stations in polar regions.
Very specific architecture there. And this is a very specific show that we were at in Glasgow. Your British station is a big part of that show, one of the four built stations that's exhibited. It's received acclaim, you know, in the design press throughout the world. Tell us a little bit about the project.
Well, Halley's a really unique place in Antarctica as a research station because it is really the only one that's located on a moving, floating ice shelf. So actually it's not properly founded on the Antarctic continent, it's literally bobbing about on the ocean. And that brings with it some amazing challenges because the ice shelf is constantly at risk of fracturing off as an iceberg. In addition, at Halley, there's the constant rising snow level that we had to deal with. So we needed to come up with some very specific solutions to ensure the long life of the station. Because Halley is on this floating ice shelf and it has the risk of breaking off on an iceberg, the British Antarctic Survey were very keen that it should be relocatable. And one way we ensured the relocatability was we split the station down into modules. We lifted it up on legs to cope with the rising snow level, they're hydraulic legs so it can climb above the snow. And then we founded all those modules on skis so that when the time comes to relocate it, we can disconnect one module from another and pull them on the giant skis to a safer location inland.
Did you feel like you were representing, you know, Britain and
British architecture as much as kind of science and innovation and things like that. There is a kind of feeling about it. There's a Union Jack on the central pod and so on. I mean, was that any kind of factor?
I think in particular since we finished it, I've felt a strong sense of Britishness about the project. Antarctica's a very curious place because on the one hand, you know, each of the stations is an embodiment of the scientific aspirations of that country. But then at the same time, it's a place of extraordinary collaboration. So people help each other to levels that perhaps they wouldn't do in the normal world. But, you know, Britain has a big part to play in the Antarctic, and Halley is a flagship project. And I suppose it wasn't overt, but there was definitely a desire to make a statement of the place of British science in the Antarctic, which is to a degree reflected in the design.
If we look at some of the other stations, whether it's India, Belgium, South Korea, do you think there's a bit of kind of archy diplomacy going on in the Antarctic? And I mean, you've certainly, if there is, you've taken part in that. Do you think that that's happening?
To a degree, we have certainly had a lot of discussion with, for example, the Germans who built a station recently, with the French as well, and with the Americans. And there's a lot of help that's gone backwards and forwards between the nations, people talking about what systems worked, what cladding types worked, and so on. But one of the great things about this exhibition that I think will come out over time is the opportunities to talk to some of the designers of some of the stations which are featured here, the Korean station, the Belgian station, and the Indian station, which was designed by a German team. And I'm really looking forward to meeting the designers of all those stations and having a good chinwag about things that problems that they had to face.
Hi, I'm Sandra Ross. I'm the curator of the exhibition and I work at Arts Catalyst. We were initially asked by the British Council to develop a show on Halley, and after doing further research on all the other sort of what else was going on in Antarctica, it seemed quite clear to me actually we should do a much more wider show encompassing some of the other fantastic examples. So the show was inspired by the architecture that's now happening in Antarctica, but equally I wanted the show to focus on the science that takes place there, because that's the reason why these buildings are built there.
So Sandra, we're standing in front of how many models? Four models of the four stations that are represented here at the show. So it's four stations, four countries really behind the different stations. In your research in curating this exhibition, did you come across any kind of differences between the different countries' approaches, or what do you think each country was trying to achieve with each of their stations?
Well, they say Antarctica amplifies people's personalities, but it also amplifies cultures. And I think that was some of my experience with some of these stations. I think, you know, Halley is quintessentially British, its approach, how it goes about things.
Why?
Well, with Halley, I think it's quite interesting in Sam Jacobs' essay in the publication. He kind of makes a parallel with this kind of James Bond type of feel about it. It's sort of parachuting from space, this kind of Union Jack landing on the ice.
Some listeners might be quite surprised to learn that actually Belgium has quite a big presence on Antarctica, as we can see by the Princess Elizabeth station. What were your feelings about that station? What kind of is the guiding principle or kind of design ethic? It's a beautiful looking kind of curved structure on this kind of podium looking out over the landscape. What was your kind of main experience in looking at that station?
Well, I mean, I know the sort of inspiration for the actual station was partly fulfilling Belgium's obligation to be part of that particular cluster in that region, but also Alain Hubert, the explorer, went out to Antarctica a few years ago and had to cancel or postpone, you know, abort his trip because the ice was so melted. And it was from that he sort of speared a kind of campaign saying, look, you know, we really need to sort of be out there, do more research about what's actually going on. And likewise, we need to sort of have a building that shows the best practice, really, in trying to reduce carbon emissions.
And finally, just to get another and very prominent country in, the South Koreans have come out with a fantastic structure on Antarctica. The only way to describe it is a spaceship. It's very Star Trek-y. How did you find that station in compared to the other ones? You know, what did you kind of find out about that one?
Well, it's certainly the biggest, and I think Korea is very keen in investing in Antarctica. But I think it's also kind of a statement about, again, their culture and their technological progress.
Also at the exhibition is Vicky Richardson, who is Director of Architecture for the exhibition's commissioners, the British Council. I ask her what's so special about Antarctic architecture right now.
Well, I think they express a huge amount of confidence and optimism in the future of architecture, which is sometimes lacking, I feel, in everyday architecture. And one of the reasons is that I think in Antarctica, you know, architects aren't responding to any particular built context. It's a virtually natural landscape that hasn't really been affected by humankind. You know, we only discovered Antarctica relatively recently, I think 1820s, and so it's not like every other part of Earth, which is a landscape that's been made and remade through agriculture, through human settlement. And so architects are faced with this sort of huge challenge, really. You know, how do you respond to that complete lack of context? And I think actually they've really risen to the challenge.
New Architecture and Science in Antarctica, which is being put on by IceLab in collaboration with the British Council and Architecture and Design Scotland, is showing at the Lighthouse in Glasgow before moving to Manchester in October and then to New Zealand. For Monocle, in Glasgow, I'm David Pleasant.
Thanks, David. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Lots more coming up, including our Paris correspondent Tom Burgess-Watson, finding out what to do with any old ski lift gondolas you may have lying around.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back. And for those just joining us, you're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, here on Monocle 24. An unlikely new development is taking place on the banks of Dundee's Craig Harbour, along the waterfront of the River Tay. London's iconic Victoria and Albert Museum, the world's largest museum dedicated to decorative arts and design, is opening a second branch in the site of a former sports facility. Last year, award-winning Japanese architect Kengo Kuma's practice won the bid to design the £45 million building, with hopes that the scheme will attract fresh inspiration and investment to the area, a Scottish Bilbao effect. Kuma has gained worldwide recognition for his architectural style, taking inspiration from the design of traditional buildings and reinterpreting them for the 21st century. Monocle's Alexa Firminich went up to Edinburgh to meet with Kuma-san during the Fringe Festival and chat with him about his design inspirations.
I think the new museum in Dundee is between nature and the city. As I want to create the conversation between nature and the city. And I got some hint from my trip to Scotland in 20 years ago. In that trip, I played golf in Scotland, in St. Andrews and Glen Eagles. And also, I enjoyed the beauty of the landscape of Scotland. It is not man-made. For my museum, I want to create that kind of the feeling. The shape of the building is what the nature want to create there. It is not box. If it is box, this is artificial, it's a man-made. But a building is very similar to the cliff. The cliff is a creation of nature. The water is cutting, engraving the land, and finally the beautiful sections are created. I want to do this, the same thing as cliff for the building. And that method is very different from the architecture of 20th century. 20th century architecture is the kind of products of the factory.
And how did the location affect your designs, the city of Dundee as a place, its character?
I was visited Dundee first time. The waterfront is boring, nothing there. But the River Tay was so beautiful. I think if the museum can be the connectors of city and nature, Dundee can get a new life. That is my first impression. And then my museum has a kind of arched shape, a gate shape, that invite the people to nature, to River Tay. And this is very similar to Japanese torii. You know, the Japanese torii, it is a gate. And the through that gate, the people try to get into the deep of nature.
How is designing a museum, and maybe particularly a museum in the United Kingdom, how is that different from other buildings that you've had to create and work with in the past?
The role of the museum is very similar to the living room in the city. In Italy and France, those countries, the plaza in the city is a kind of living space in the city. But in UK, the people are using the museum as a part of the public life. And it is very different from Louvre Museum. In Louvre Museum, it is a space for exhibition. And the art is separated from the daily life. But in UK, I feel another kind of relationship is art.
So in terms of design architecture, how do you adapt that thought and the fact that it's a living space and not just an exhibition hall? Does that relate back to the use of space and the openness of the building?
Yeah, for my museum, the main foyer is huge. Comparing with normal museum, it's a huge space and also the very dramatic space. As probably people can use that public space, the main foyer, as amphitheaters or as a space for concerts. That can kind of use is very possible in our main foyer. And also we are designing that space by the use of very natural warm material. As many the timbers are there. And also we are designing the wood benches in that space. And the people can sit those benches, they can meet together with friends. And that kind of use are very possible there.
That was Monocle's Alexa Firminich in Scotland with Kengo Kuma. What do you do with an old ski lift gondola? It's not a question many of us have ever had to ponder, but it's one Swiss charity called the Verbier Mountain Climbers has had an ingenious answer to nonetheless. Together with a group of designers, they've been giving a very new lease of life to some of these decommissioned télécabines. An old-school vending machine, a mirrored screen, and a four-seater rocking chair are just some of the new uses this iconic piece of industrial design have been put to. They have delighted the crowds at Design Miami Basel and will remain on display at Geneva Airport until they're auctioned off in the autumn. We sent our Paris correspondent, Tom Burgess-Watson, to meet Albert Schruer, an architect and co-founder of the Verbier Mountain Climbers. They met up in the recently unveiled new-look Place de la République in the heart of the French capital.
The Verbier Mountain Climbers are a group of Swiss people with two friends of mine, Nicolas Bernheim and Ines Flammarion. And it's basically a group of Swiss designers who were invited to transform old ski gondolas and give them a second life.
And how on earth did you come up with the idea of transforming an old, once-used télécabine or cable car gondola?
I've been going to Verbier since I'm 4 years old, so I've been seeing them for quite a long time. I've always found them quite fascinating. And it's a beautiful industrial design object, and I found it quite a pity when I've heard that they were going to be dismantled and just thrown away. So that's about it, and it was a great adventure starting.
So is that what happens to an old cable car in the mountains, that once it's been in circulation for a certain number of years, they just scrap it?
Yes, more or less. Those have been going on for 40 years, and once they get too old-fashioned and they don't get approved by the regulations anymore, then they just get dismantled. Either they are sold to other locations and then they're shipped out to Russia or elsewhere, and then if not, they're just being thrown away, and then they get a second life, but quite boring usually.
Let's talk a little bit about the transformation process from télécabine to a new lease of life. What sorts of things have they been turned into?
Among the seven that we have actually made, we have a rocking chair. So basically Adrien Rovero decided to give this feeling of rocking that you can feel in the gondola. We have a paravent. It's a just a big screen, an interior screen made out of the doors of the gondolas by Jörg Bonheur and Leila Scherer. We also have a giant vending machine by Ekal Baker Bardlow. He decided that it looked exactly like a small vending machine, but he wanted to recreate this big scale, change of scale. So those are the three main iconic projects, we also have projects which were more transformed, like a table by Nicolas Lemoigne, or a sort of recreated imaginative helicopter by Atelier Oi.
The vending machine is extraordinary. I loved it, actually. It's so colourful, and just for our listeners, to give them a sense of what it looks like, it's kept the glass sides and front, and inside it's filled with those sort of colourful balls that when you were a child you always begged your parents to let you buy one of, and it's got a sort of a rather cheap toy or candy or something inside it. Do you have a personal favourite?
Well, I really enjoy Atelier Oise because it's so simple. It's all white and it's really typical of their work. And as a design process, it's really interesting for me because it's going to be for them a new process for future objects as well. This work is part of their research. So I'm quite happy about this because it's not always easy to get big designers to work on such projects.
What was the reaction of the cable car operator, Télé Verbier, when you approached them and said, look, we'd like some of your old télécabine to turn into new objects? Were they quite supportive from the outset, or did they need a bit of convincing?
The first day I had the idea, I called them immediately. I'm quite spontaneous. And I told them, okay, are you going to dismantle this line? And they said, yes. I said, okay, how much would the gondola cost? At first they gave me a price, so I looked in my savings and I said, okay, can I have 40, please? And they said nothing. They had quite a minute of silence because they were a bit surprised by someone wanting to get 40 of them. And then they said, okay, I'm going to call you back with a better offer, so which they did. And at first we were going to buy them, and then as the project became a charity project, they decided to offer them to us.
And over the years, has the design of the gondola stayed pretty similar, or is there a whole range of different styles of télécabine, or are they all pretty much the same?
They're actually quite fascinating. I mean, not to be too collective or anything, but those are really beautiful because they have quite unique design. All the windows are curved. They're made out of one piece of plastic instead of being framed like they are today, by metal on both sides, and then they are supported under the gondola instead of being held by above the gondola. I don't know if I'm explaining it quite correctly, but the whole structural process is different. And also they have a central poteau. How do we say it?
Like a rod or a pole?
Yeah, a pole, a central pole, which they don't have anymore, which is always a pain when you go in the gondola because you always hit on it. But today they got rid of it, but they changed the structural feeling of it.
Do all the ski resorts tend to have a similar design of télécabine, or is the one in Verbier really unique just to that ski resort?
Well, that particular gondola that we recuperated is actually one of those which was the most implanted around the world and in Switzerland, because it took place in the 70s, which was the explosion of ski resorts. And so we can even find those ski gondolas in the Bronx Zoo or Brooklyn Zoo in New York, which I quite find interesting.
They've got to some extraordinary places, haven't they, these gondolas? Tell us a little bit about where your reinvented gondolas have been on display and where they're going to go on display.
The first one, by Adrien Rovero, started being displayed at the Museum of Design in Lausanne, then was exhibited at Art Genève during the second edition of the fair in January. And then in Theo Jacob, the biggest design reseller in Switzerland. And then they were premiered with the six others at Design Miami Fair in Basel in last June. And now they're going to be shown in Geneva Airport, in Verbier, and probably in a few other locations which won't be disclosed until this fall.
Because the autumn is an important time, isn't it, for your project? Because all these gondolas are going to be auctioned off by Christie's, is that right?
The fall is going to be really important because it's the final perspective of this project. We have the Christie's auction, which will be held on October 8th at the Geneva Airport, and all the benefits will go to the Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Supposing someone wanted to buy one at auction, are you able to say anything about the guide price that they might have to think about bidding?
Well, today anyone can bid whatever they want. There's a starting price around 5,000 Swiss francs. But it's Christie's will set it, and we have already received quite many offers during Design Miami Fair. We are already taking silent bids through forms which we can find online on the website.
And what sort of reception have your gondolas had? What sort of reaction have people had to them? Have they immediately recognized that it's a, a gondola from the mountains that's been given a new lease of life?
Yes, they immediately, every people got a smile on their face, which was quite nice for us after three years of working on this project. We got really a lot of press with this project. We had great feedbacks from museum and from different exhibition organizers. Everybody enjoys it, and the children love it as well, which is quite good with this charity project for children as well. So yeah, we're really happy with the feedback so far.
That was Albert Schruer speaking to Monocle's Tom Burgess-Watson. Still to come in part two, we'll find out why London's Design Museum is countering the city's eastward creative brain drain and setting up shop in Kensington. But now we'll head to Istanbul for this episode's studio visit. Sandwiched between the Karaköy shore on the Bosphorus and the bustling İstiklal Avenue sits the Shishani-based design studio of Asla and Chan Alte, husband and wife and part-time collaborative designers. From here, Asla runs her graphic design company, Future Anecdote Society, while Chan focuses on his projects as one of Istanbul's emerging artists. Over a cup of afternoon chai, they give the Section D team a tour of their studio, revealing their work, their neighbourhood, and their inspirations.
This is where we work, and also this place becomes a pop-up bookshop on the weekends with one invited publisher rather than like a normal bookshop. We invite a single publisher and we display their books. We also make it available for sale. Future Anecdotes started in London in 2009 with a partner. After staying 2 years in London, we moved to Istanbul after actually getting married with Can. And initially, I'm a book designer. I design books, and that's what I'm specialized on. But on the two most recent years, we've started working with the space, meaning the exhibition design, display structures, and the navigation systems. So that's what we basically and mainly do, book design and exhibition design.
It's like a typical inner city, like turn of century Istanbul building, meaning like early 1900s.
And for work, we wanted to be close to the production because around us, and especially if you go down here and go towards Karaköy, you can get almost anything made from metal to wood and to paper, and you can find the, you know, source materials and lots of inspiration as well when you're going around, actually. For some of the Can's art projects, we collaborate on some publications, so we can say I think 40% of the work we do is together, is a collaboration.
So, I mean, as I said in the beginning, I'm an artist, and for me, the studio is more a place to oversee the process of various projects that I undertake, and this involves like from its conception to, let's say, accumulating notes, drawings, sketches.
My inspiration still and has used to come from literature mainly, not really design or visual work, I have to say, and that's how my mind works. Instead of making sketches, I take notes and write about the design rather than draw about, you know, how it will look like. And things like George Perec and Italia Calvino and the Olipo movement, which is very much about when the words become actually shapes and they have other meanings than what they convey, they perform on the page. That really inspires me, and it still does.
I originally studied architecture, but somehow I was always intrigued and maybe you can say inspired by the way actually the city and the people themselves make space. So I started off with kind of looking at situations where maybe you can say architecture is almost transgressed or irrelevant. So these kind of notions of how to think about public space, how meaning is produced and how we decide on the ways that we live on the city, and also how we can challenge the at times oppressive modes of living that are imposed on public space, and whether our inhabitation, whether how we inhabit these systems or contexts can challenge the ways that are in some ways imposed on us.
That was Aslı and Çağan Altay showing us around their studio in Turkey. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. After this interlude, we'll be hearing about a new publication documenting how sex affects the way we build.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
This is Section D on Monocle 24. Welcome back. Who would have imagined that our sexual attitudes in the last century influenced modern architecture? That's precisely the topic of a new book by author Richard Williams, appropriately called Sex and Buildings, Modern Architecture and the Sexual Revolution. From love hotels in Brazil to the Playboy Mansion, sex is present everywhere in the buildings in our cities. And yes, the phallic-shaped modern skyscrapers are mentioned as well. Our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, met Richard at Midori House.
I think what I'm interested in is the way that sex lives, our sex lives and buildings are connected, and that it seems to me that we now live very long, very complex lives, but the buildings that we inhabit tend to represent older or more old-fashioned versions of sexuality. So I think thinking about modern buildings, then there were some attempts in the 20th century to reimagine sexuality as something different, something more modern. And you see that a bit in architecture of, say, Le Corbusier or Oscar Niemeyer in Brazil. But I think this is the whole question is very complex and needs more research, needs more work.
And I mean, you did mention Niemeyer now, and shall we talk a little bit about modernism in Brazil? You know, that there is this image that of being kind of erotically charged. Is this true?
Again, that's a very good question. I went to Brazil the first time maybe 12 or 13 years ago, and I visited many times since then. And it was precisely that question that I was interested in. And I have to say that nothing ever very interesting happened to me in Brazil. And it seemed to me that the kinds of lives that my colleagues might have in Brazil were really very similar to the kinds of lives that they might have anywhere else, that they were preoccupied with money and family and work and all of those things that really stop you maybe having a more liberated sexual life, let's say. They were worried about all the same things. But having said that, in Brazil, there is this tradition of modern architecture that celebrates the body. There are traditions of going to the beach, there are traditions of being outside and doing things, showing off the body in a way that doesn't happen in, say, Northern Europe. So those things are important and things that we can work with, I think.
And it's interesting, you have a lot of lovely pictures on your book as well. And there's this picture here in the beach house in Newport Beach, California. Mm. And it's interesting, you can see those areas that actually they're made for open-air sleeping, yeah. Right? So sometimes the architects, they really kind of plan the building, thinking about sex somehow.
I think so. Yeah, Schindler, it's Rudolf Schindler is the architect there. And his Newport Beach house from, I think, 1926 is one of a series of houses that have very well-developed open-air spaces. And yeah, he was certainly thinking about sex. The problem with his buildings tended to be that the clients he built for had often rather tragic lives, and they ended up being buildings that housed a lot of frustration and anxiety. There are rather sad stories. So the King's Road house is the classic example, which he built for himself and his wife, and initially for Richard Neutra and his wife, and the two couples living together, lots of space in the open air. They were thinking of camping and a free, open, sexually liberal life, but the reality of that, the life that they lived in the house, was miserable. I mean, two couples who both ended up in all sorts of trouble and no fun. It was a no-fun house.
Oh, dear. And another aspect of cities, I mean, some buildings that have obvious sexual connotation, which are those huge towers. I mean, every city has their own skyscrapers, and they have this the phallic shape. And do you think there is a connection with sex and power, or what is the meaning? Do you think there is a thought behind that?
That was the obvious starting point for a lot of people. When I told people I was writing a book about sex and buildings, they said, you must be writing about phallic architecture. And I did say a little bit about it. It's a slight interest. Actually, it's not really that interesting in the end. I mean, you can say, when you start reading into this, you find that every building looks like a penis, you know, and so what, you know. There's that. The most interesting connection I found was where it was actually Norman Foster's buildings, and the surfaces of his towers were very masculine, I thought. And there was a lot of attention paid to masculine functions and bathrooms. He spends a lot of time with bathrooms, and they're beautifully done. The picture that I reproduced of his architecture was from the Commerzbank in Frankfurt, where there's a male bathroom right at the top of the building, beautiful view of the city of Frankfurt from 50 stories up, and it's a row of four urinals. So literally the chief executives of the Commerzbank, as they go to the toilet, they're peeing over the whole city. And I thought that was, you know, a very nice joke, but also a slightly problematical one.
That was Richard Williams with our Fernando Augusto Pacheco. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Next, London's Design Museum is moving. The former banana ripening warehouse in Shad Thames, which is currently home to London's Design Museum, has been sold to Zaha Hadid Architects. As the creative bandwagoners continue to head eastward, London's Design Museum is heading in the opposite direction. The museum will join some of the British capital's long-established cultural bastions, such as the Victoria and Albert Museum, the Royal College of Art, and the Serpentine Gallery in Kensington's Cultural Quarter. Intent on becoming the world's foremost museum of design and architecture, construction is now well underway to transform the Grade 2 listed former Commonwealth Institute in West London, which has lain dormant for over a decade. Annabel Bly caught up with the Design Museum's director, Dejan Sucic, about the move.
I was hired a few years ago with a brief to take the Design Museum to its next level. We've been where we are at Shad Thames, just by Tower Bridge, in a former banana ripening warehouse for 25 years. We have about 200,000 visitors a year here, and we're relatively modest in scale. It's about 3,000 square metres. And the plan really is to move to somewhere we can actually do much more. We can show more of our collection, we have a bigger education programme and a livelier exhibition programme. Initially, we thought about working with Tate Modern. They offered us a site behind the Turbine Hall. We considered that for a while. And then we were offered the chance to bring back to life a 1960s landmark, the former Commonwealth Institute, in the borough of Kensington and Chelsea. And that seemed like a really fascinating opportunity. As a child, it's somewhere I went on school trips. In those days, it seemed like the most modern interior in London. And after the Commonwealth moved out of the building 10, 15 years ago, it's been struggling to find a new use, and it's been gently decaying. And the chance to actually bring it back to life, to give the museum 10,000 square metres in a place in which we think, when we open in 2015, the end of 2015, we'll be looking at something like 500,000 visitors a year, is a fantastic chance to do something special.
Yeah, the museum will be going through a bit of a resurrection. Could you tell me a little bit more about some of the plans that you've got? I understand there's a new housing development which is going to be a significant part of the new structure.
The move is part of a wider development. Rem Koolhaas and OMA were hired by Chelsfield Developers for the site, who acquired it from the Commonwealth some time ago, to build a housing scheme. And the Kensington Chelsea's planners said, yes, that's fine, but in order to get planning consent, we need to find a cultural user for the exhibition building. So it's a partnership. Our presence makes the housing development planning permission possible, and in exchange we've had a substantial financial contribution from the developers towards the cost of fixing our building.
You must be quite excited to be joining the sort of West London cultural sphere. So as you mentioned, you've got the V&A close by, all the various museums, as well as the Royal College of Art and other artistic institutions. Are you looking forward to new partnerships with some of those?
There's something wonderfully counterintuitive. While the rest of London is shooting off eastward, we are heading back towards the west. It's nice to zig while others zag. It's interesting, Kensington High Street, where the museum will be, was in the 60s and early 70s one of the most interesting parts of London, and it's lost that sense of specialness. It's had some of the life sucked out of it, and one of the reasons that Kensington Chelsea wants us to be there is the sense that we can help bring that street back to life.
Fantastic. And I understand the current site here at Shad Thames is being taken over by Zaha Hadid. Do you have any idea what kind of plans that she's got for the building?
We're very fortunate for our fundraising. Terence Connor, the museum's founder, gave us the lease of the existing museum building in Shad Thames with a brief to dispose of it at its maximum value, which goes straight to our new building fund. But we're very glad that it's gone to the best possible hands. Zaha Hadid has bought the building, and I'm sure whatever she does, it's going to be a fascinating use of the building.
Dejan Sujic, speaking to Monocle's Annabel Bly there. Monocle's fashion director, Takaharu Sato, recently returned from a trip to Copenhagen, where he indulged in the city's biannual Fashion Week. As the event slowly takes the crown from its sister, Stockholm Fashion Week, for Scandinavian's most exciting sartorial one to watch, he'd join me in the studio to discuss the movers and the shakers keeping the city well-dressed.
I remember a few years ago, we did a film on Copenhagen Fashion Week, mm-hmm. and I did a narration for that, picking up Copenhagen as an emerging Scandinavian fashion capital. And indeed, if you go see what's happening in town, like, you feel much more energy, you know, in terms of new brands creating new, of course, like new products, and obviously like young talented entrepreneurs starting new businesses, not only fashion but also like dining and eating as well, and, you know, launching new retail businesses. So in comparison to Stockholm, I feel it's more buzzing, and also like, yes, so many things happening. And when we have some like night outs, especially like when it comes to Fashion Week, there are lots of like events and parties happening, especially like a 2008 and, you know, Lehman Brothers thing happened. Like I could see lots of brands like started cutting corners. Like they used to throw lots of parties, but they just sort of shrink the size of the like parties or presentations. But now, like, I can see like lots of Danish fashion brands started coming back to sort of do more bigger size parties. So you feel like generally, like when I speak to also like fashion buyers or the store owners such as Rasmus Storm, mm-hmm. when we run the film on monocle.com reporting on Copenhagen Fashion Week, I remember commenting that the economy is getting back to pre-crisis level. But not even just pre-crisis level. Of course, it's still like fragile market, but I'm quite looking forward to seeing the sort of like sales figures and stuff, because now I heard from a lot of people that saying like, oh, like sales has been really good. The products are kind of like, yeah, flying out, and we don't have many things left in the stockyard. Like, wow. I hear lots of good signs, and I hear lots of comments, and I see good signs. And yeah. So
there's a huge appetite for fashion up there, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, they
love brands.
Absolutely. And also, like, of course, they are trying to expand further in terms of their market. Danish fashion labels are well received in, of course, Scandinavia, especially Northern Europe and Germany, Norway, a bit of Finland and England here. Mm. I was speaking to this lady called Eva Cruz, who is the CEO of Danish Fashion Institute. Mm-hmm. So they're organizing this whole fashion event. And she said, I recognize lots of talented young Danish people, but they seem to still like stay in the Northern European market. Mm-hmm. And they want to promote younger talents to, especially like Asia, Japan, China, Southeast Asia. So I think in the few years' time, I can predict a bit of like expansion of Danish fashion labels.
So who are the major players in Denmark?
On top of the list, I would say Soland. This designer, very young guy called Silas Adler, he has a skater background and started doing this label. A little bit of skater feeling meets well-tailored pieces. And he discovered some great tailors in Portugal. So those are well-tailored pieces. And of course, like manufacturing in Portugal, it used to be for many European brands, like producing lots of things because production cost was cheaper. Mm. But now, made in Portugal is becoming also a brand as well. Soland has been recognized very well, especially in the last few years in the Danish fashion industry. And when it comes to like a Scandinavian fashion, like it's we perceive like it's clean design and well cut and etc. And the Silas pushed up a little bit of funkiness. It's woven with this like a clean Scandinavian design.
Mm. So because they're quite into sort of streetwear.
Yeah, yeah.
Aren't they? I mean, that's what I've noticed. You do get the sort of that very Scandinavian thing that sort of Celine's picked up on, but increasingly they into their urban gear.
Yeah, exactly. In Scandinavia. Yeah, exactly.
So Denmark.
Yeah. And I have seen this label Soland since the last 5 years almost. And obviously, like that designer grows up and his taste has also like grown up. And then you can see like, oh, this brand has been becoming more mature.
Mm.
It's not as streety as it used to be.
Mm.
And I quite like the fact that it's been growing up. So it's more like wearable for not only like a teenager's early 20s, but also like people around the 30s could consume the brand. And yeah, I saw some like a good press coverage in the Danish magazines and like cover about Soland and it's expanding in the Northern Europe. And also they've got some stockists in Japan as well.
Oh, wow.
So that's one of the sort of biggest players in Denmark. And also I should mention Han Copenhagen.
Mm.
Sorry for my Danish accent, but Han Copenhagen. We featured this brand last year when they launched the shop. It was actually this time last year. And it's beautifully designed, some Hans Wegner pieces in for the furniture. And they specialize in indigo pieces. And they do well-crafted denim jeans and denim shirts and etc. And the collection has expanded. They make more pieces. And I saw one of their bags like in the shop called Goods.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, really made well. And so like these two brands are what I kind of remark for the moment.
You did mention shops there. Any interesting new retail destinations you
yes.
spotted?
Yes, I just mentioned the name Goods. I went there actually for the first time. But this guy called Casper launched the shop 5 years ago. And it was tucked away. And I couldn't notice it. Then I met this guy a few weeks ago in London when he came to see Jacket Required trade show. And, oh yeah, why don't you pop by? You know, oh, I'll be in Copenhagen next week. So I went to see his shop located on one of the main streets in Copenhagen. So it's more like a visible and the size is bigger. And then it's beautifully like a clean design. And he stocks like Folk, Our Legacy, Macintosh, Filson, and so on. So it's like a the products or brands we like, and then it's well curated, and it's not really usual thing to do in Copenhagen. If you go see some stockists in London or New York or Canada, like you might see this type of retailers, but there are not many in Copenhagen. So like I would want to support him. He's got really good taste.
That was Monocle's fashion director Takaharu Sato, closing this week's edition of Section D, the first of many more with me at the helm. Today's show is produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact Aled at awj@monocle.com if you want to feature on Section D. I'm Tom Morris. Playing you out of this slightly icy episode, here's Madonna with Frozen. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.